Despite the title of Douglas Edwards' memoir, I'm Feeling Lucky, he's neither bragging nor admitting to being a compulsive gambler. Instead, he's one of Google's first hires, number 59 to be exact, and he tells the stories of those heady days of Super Soaker fights and unlimited sushi when the Don't Be Evil company was just about to leave the Garden of Eden and face the temptations of the real world. His book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Douglas Edwards to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Did you name the I'm Feeling Lucky button?
I did not. That was in place before I came to Google.
Was that button useful?
You know, it was more about expressing confidence in the ability of Google to find what you were looking for with the first attempt. It very rarely was used by most users.
I don't think I've ever used it.
Then you're in good company.
I want something more specific. How does a non-engineer manage to get hired as Google's 59th employee?
Well, they reached a point where I think they realized they needed somebody to do all of the work that they didn't want to do, all the things.
How far into the company's history was that?
This would have been in November of 1999.
And how old was the company then?
I was a little over a year old, as an entity. So
were you part of the first wave of hiring at Google?
There was always an emphasis on hiring, and so they mostly had been looking for engineers prior to that. But I was in the first wave of non-engineering hires, which included the massage therapist, the chef, and some other people in marketing.
Well, they told you money was tight and they couldn't do much in your department, but they still thought that it was okay to hire a massage therapist and a chef?
Well, you know, I think the belief was that a massage therapist and a chef would help improve productivity among the engineers, and they weren't quite so sure that marketing would do the same. So they would put the emphasis on things that actually led to direct productivity improvements.
Most companies that are started by engineer types, nerds and whatever, eventually realize that they have to bring in people from the outside because they have limited perspectives. But Google seems to hire those people and then fire them, whereas everybody else winds up naming them president.
Yeah. Well, Google is not a marketing company. I mean, they're not a company that believes you should build your dominance of a market or your market presence based on telling people how great your product is. They believe the product should speak for itself.
So they don't want to run ads the way Apple has run ads?
Well, they ran a Super Bowl ad recently, which was a shock to me because for the longest time they did not want to run any ads. And there's this sort of myth around that Google never did any advertising. We did do some, but we just didn't like to pay for it.
Well, it was mostly word of mouth. I remember the first time somebody asked me why I didn't just Google it.
Yeah. Well, and surprisingly, a lot of people do remember the first time they used Google or the first time they heard about it. And I came to think of that as the joy of discovery, that people would feel a special connection with a brand because they had discovered Google themselves because somebody had told them or they had read it in a publication. And that was a much deeper emotional connection than seeing an ad for it.
A listener has written in, Carl in Palos Verdes, California. He writes, I interviewed at Google a few years back. People were very enthusiastic about me, but that vanished immediately after they saw me. Their faces fell. Perhaps I'm hideously ugly, but I think it's more likely that I was obviously in my 40s. I've heard similar stories from people even more obviously brilliant than I. Perhaps we're all just crybabies with exaggerated senses of our talents and or their usefulness for Google, but perhaps Google are wasting a potential pool of employees.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and Google has been accused, you know, in a lawsuit of age discrimination. And, you know, clearly I was in my 40s when I started working there.
But they asked you about your grade point average, and
yes,
that was
did.
20 years after you graduated, and, so they were still thinking in those terms.
It was very hard for me to come up with it, I have to tell you. But it wasn't – I don't think that was an age-specific question. I think Google liked metrics. They liked to have data that they could use in computing whether or not to make a decision. So a GPA and an SAT score were two data points that they could plot on a chart and say, okay, here's your SAT score indicates your intelligence, your capability. Your GPA indicates your ability to execute on that So it's not just that you're smart, but that you're actually productive. And so they would take those 2 points and they'd look at that and say, okay, well, he's smart and he can produce.
And that, it doesn't predict anything.
Absolutely. Ultimately. I totally agree.
So what was your background? Had you ever worked on the internet before?
I had become familiar with the internet. I was working for the San Jose Mercury News, which was the newspaper of Silicon Valley, as we like to call it. And I was in charge of online branding for them and online product development. So I certainly had familiarity with what was going on outside the doors of the paper in Silicon Valley.
But you want to get out of the newspaper business because you saw that as a dying business.
Well, I saw that it was having difficulty making the transition to a new digital world.
And so how do you go about hunting for a job with an internet firm?
Well, you send out a lot of resumes. You do a lot of interviewing. And you have to remember back in 1999 when this was taking place, everything was an internet firm. Everybody was starting a company. There were literally thousands of startups in Silicon Valley that you could talk to. A lot of them were not very substantial and disappeared fairly quickly.
And were you worried about that, the fragility of most of the startups?
No, I actually didn't expect Google to last. I expected Google to be around for maybe a year. I mean, they had some pretty good funding. I figured it would take them at least a year to blow through that. But my expectation was I would get this great experience working for an internet company, see how things were done in Silicon Valley, and then I could bring that expertise back and work for a traditional media company.
And what was on your resume that enticed them to even consider you?
Well, I had done some interesting things in promoting our online brands at the Mercury News, and the woman who hired me at Google had come out of Apple. She was a PR person and also had worked for a newspaper. So we had a connection, and they seemed to like some of the things that I had done creatively. And they were interested in viral marketing in particular.
Well, Apple has done quite nicely through marketing.
Yes, they have.
And I would think that Google, which in recent years seems to be falling behind Apple, Apple now the largest company in the field, and they created the iPhone. Apple then had to then Google had to come up with an imitation. I would think that they might be rethinking their situation, but they don't.
Well, I mean, Google and Apple have a very interesting relationship, which has evolved over time. But
they've been friends and then enemies.
Yes, and competitors. I wouldn't say enemies, but competitors. And, the cultures are different. Apple is very much centered around Steve Jobs. And from what I understand, I've never worked there. But, I mean, he really directs everything from a kind of top down. And he's, I think, a real believer in marketing. You know, marketing is a way to control your message and deliver exactly the impression you want of your products. Google is much more democratic, if you will, in terms of letting users form their own opinions. They would rather people interact with the technology, interact with the product, and then make up their own mind. And, I quoted Larry at one point in the book saying—
This is Larry Page.
Larry Page, one of the co-founders of Google. I made exactly that argument to him that at some point, all the search engines are going to have the same technology, and then branding will be necessary for us to distinguish. Marketing will be necessary for us to distinguish our product. And he just looked at me and said, if we can't win on quality, then we don't deserve to win at all.
Well, I get my sense from reading this book is that Larry Page and Sergey Brin want to create an environment that looks democratic. But when the chips are down, they not only have the final word, they are the dictators. They are it's almost a totalitarian situation after they've consulted with everybody.
Well, they like to get a lot of input, and they are open
to— But they always turn out to be right.
Yeah, funny how that works sometimes. But they are, especially if it's input from people they respect, input backed with data, they can be convinced. And, an example of that was improving the advertising system.
Well, what did you think when you were told that theirs was a flat organization without defined roles? Do you think that was a good way to run a company?
I do. I think it eliminated a lot of kind of the jockeying that goes on in traditional companies where you know exactly where you are on the org chart and you measure your office and see if it's bigger or smaller than the guy that you think you're competing with or the gal you think you're competing with. None of that really happened. People were not focused on their own status, their own relationship in the company to the others. People were focused on trying to get the product as good as it could be.
Well, since there's no hierarchy, there still has to be some kind of determination that this person is doing better than that person. And doesn't that the more successful one move up the ladder in some way?
Well, there are very few rungs on the ladder, you know, and I tell a story in the book about the fact that I was dealing with an outside company, and I had brought in a very junior person at Google, meaning someone who had just started, who was very young, and this person, vice president I was negotiating this deal with, said to me, "I'm sorry, I don't want to be rude, but I don't deal with people at that level, and, you know, I mean, I only deal with decision-making executives." And I said, "Well, that's fine, but you have to understand this person has been given the responsibility for this product. And if she says that it's not a good deal for us to do, it won't happen. And if she says it is a good deal for us to do, it'll end up on Larry and Sergey's desk." And that's just the way Google is. You know, people have the authority that comes with their role.
And how did that other person respond?
He backed down. He was willing to engage her in the conversation.
My guest is Douglas Edwards. He's written a book called I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You sent in your resume. They nibbled. You had to clear this with your wife and
yes.
Your kids.
Yeah. Well, the kids were a little young to clear it with, but I did have to clear it with my wife.
Was she nervous about this?
Well, by the time I was offered the job, she was a little unsettled because it involved taking a $25,000 pay cut, and there was no clear source of revenue for Google at the time.
But you did have the possibility of stock options, which could have meant nothing, as we saw with the dot-com bubble. A lot of people thought they were rich, and then one day
right. They
suddenly had nothing.
Right. Usually meant nothing. Stock options in Silicon Valley, I mean, everybody wants them, but in most cases they turn out to be worthless. So it was hardly a sure thing. And she finally, you know, she recognized that I needed to make a change. I'd been at the newspaper for 7 years and wanted to do something different.
Were you interviewed by Larry Page and Sergey Brin?
I was interviewed by Sergey.
Did you find that you had much in common?
Well, I thought we did because I walked in. I knew he had been born in Russia, and my wife is a Russian historian, and we had spent 6 months in Siberia while she was doing her doctoral research. So I felt, you know, oh, we're going to be very simpatico. You know, I'll be able to talk to him in Russian, and we'll talk about, you know, our common ground. And it didn't go exactly the way I expected. You know, he was very much more interested in how we could market Google cheaply and save money on the marketing budget.
Well, they didn't believe in marketing, but he wanted to market.
Well, I think what I found out later was he had outside pressure from his board of directors. They thought Google should have a marketing team. And I'm not sure he was entirely convinced, but he was willing to go along with it for a while.
He had a traditional last question. What was it?
What he used to call the hard question. And that question was, tell me about something that I don't already know. And he'd give you 5 minutes to think about it. And
I'd hate that question.
Oh, it was a very difficult question to try to come up
with
an
answer. I'm going to start asking guests that.
I'm sure they'd appreciate that. Tell me something I don't already know. And, you know, I mean, you're
well,
searching.
How do you know what somebody doesn't know?
Exactly. Well, you know, and I talk in the book. I mean, I thought about, you know, we just had
a third child. You don't know that I have a fungus on my toes.
Exactly.
How could...
Well, he wanted, you know, he didn't want to waste his time. And he felt like if he interviewed candidates and he made them answer a question that left him more knowledgeable than when he started, even if he didn't hire that candidate, at least it hadn't been a waste of his time.
Well, you when did you find out that they had just fired their advertising consultant?
Well, he was on the way out as I came in. And it was made very clear to me early on that marketing was not going to be a big budget department.
Did they offer you the job?
They did.
And what did you tell them?
Well, I told them that, you know, and this is something I haven't really talked about, but that they'd have to give me more money than they were intending because I couldn't afford to pay my taxes if they didn't.
You actually had to borrow money from your parents to buy some of the stock options.
Yes, yes. It was a bit of a financial squeeze for me for some time.
Were they willing to go the extra mile?
My parents or
Google?
Larry and Sergey. They did. They fought hard, but ultimately they gave me enough to pay my tax bill.
You were older than most of the people there.
I was.
Did that have an effect on the work environment for you?
You know, there was an energy level that comes with having a lot of people who are fresh out of college, who are kind of continuing the graduate student life. And it wasn't that it was hard for me to keep up with them. It was more the life balance issue, because I had a family at home that I also had to give a fair amount of energy to.
Well, going into the job, did you see yourself as someone who could guide them into a real-world corporation?
Oh, of course. I mean, I had 20 years of marketing experience. How could they not benefit from that? And what I discovered was that they actually didn't value experience so much as new ways of thinking about things.
Well, what were the goals in the late, at this time, late 1999?
Well, you know, I think Larry and Sergey had, in particular Larry, who I think drove the vision of the company, had a fairly clear idea of what he thought Google could be. He didn't communicate that very well or very often to those of us who were working in other parts of the company. So I never was completely clear on what the goal of our efforts was, other than to improve the technology and grow our audience of users. So I knew that those were things that we were trying to do, but I certainly didn't see a long-term strategy beyond that.
Well, that's because of sending out a mixed message. On the one hand, you don't want to be competitive. You don't want to be like all those other places. At the same time, you want to be the biggest.
Well, I wouldn't say they didn't want to be competitive. I mean, they wanted to be the biggest. I don't even think it was a matter of they wanted to be the biggest. They expected to be the biggest. They knew they would be the biggest. And it was really more a matter—
Well, why did they? There are a lot of other very smart engineers out there. People understand algorithms and can do all the stuff that they did.
Well, I think that this is what makes somebody start a company. The absolute belief that they've created a technology that is so superior, that is so much better than what exists in the market, that people will flock to it and use it. And Google happened to be such a technology. It was a free product. It didn't cost anything to use it. It was immediately obvious that it was better than the competitors because all you had to do was one search.
Well, Yahoo was out there. What was it, Ask?
Ask Jeeves was out there at the time, but AltaVista was the best search engine at that particular time. And if you did a search on AltaVista and you did a search on Google, you could clearly tell that the results on Google were superior. And so that led people to want to use it. And it was a free product, so there was no switching cost. There was no difficulty in moving from one to the next.
What did they think? How did they think they were going to pay for all of this?
Well, even in their original business plan that they took around to the venture capital firms, they talked about revenue coming from either selling the technology, licensing the technology, or advertising, or both. And so advertising was always part of the mix, but Larry and Sergey didn't like advertising very much. Even in their original paper that they published at Stanford about the technology, they warned about the dangers of advertising and its ability to corrupt the purity of the results.
But they've changed.
Well, I think it's not that they've changed. It's that they believe that they have figured out a way to do it that doesn't corrupt the search results. They've made a very clear editorial distinction between, you know, search results and advertising, which a lot of their competitors early on did not do.
Is that totally true? People who use Gmail often complain that they've had an innocent conversation with a friend through their email. And the next thing you know, all of this stuff starts popping up that relates to it. That's advertising, isn't it?
It
also, for many people, feels like invasion of privacy. That's not very idealistic.
Well, okay. There are several issues kind of co-joined there. First off, search results and Gmail are different. Okay, so search results.
The same company.
Well, it is the same company, but you have a very different experience when you're searching for something and you're expecting objective results determined by an algorithm. Other companies were putting ads directly into the results, interstitching them with the results and making it unclear what was paid for and what was not. Google determined very early on they would absolutely not do that. Now, Gmail, when you're sending and receiving messages, they're automatically scanned for viruses and all kinds of things by every company that hosts an email service. And Google is simply using that same technology, that same scanning technology, to understand you know, what the content of the message is. But nobody's reading your email. It may feel like it, but it's not. And, you know, that's not actually the case.
Did they check up on you through the internet?
Did they Google me?
Yeah.
At that point, it probably would have been a little harder to do. I don't know that my footprint online was as large as it's grown.
My guess is Douglas Edwards, his book, I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Douglas Edwards, who was the Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management at Google from 1999 to 2005 and was responsible for setting the tone and direction of the company's communications with its users. He has written a book called I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You talk about some of the people you worked with. You describe one of them as reminding you very much of Dustin Hoffman of Rain Man. Was he an idiot savant?
No, he had a very open way about him that belied the fact that he actually had a medical degree from Yale and had been a practicing neurosurgeon before he became Google's technology operations guy.
Well, people assume that all of these people were techie nerds. Were they weird?
No. I think there's a common misconception that, you know, everybody has got pasty white skin and never leaves the office and can't communicate with other people. And I found many of the engineers to be quite eloquent, very educated, very interested in everything going on around them, had a lot of, you know, outside activities that they participated in.
And they had a lot more education than you. Didn't you mispronounce the word router?
I did. One of many technology terms that I didn't quite get. I think I was calling it router at the time. Yes.
Well, you were a roto router.
Yes, I was a – yes. We won't go there. But, there were a number of advanced degrees. I had a BA and no real preparation other than one class in computer science that I had taken.
And then there was this, as you say, this kind of college dorm sensibility there. Did you get involved with throwing stuff around?
Oh, yeah.
Threw food and all of that?
Not so much food fights. Charlie the chef would have been very unhappy if we'd wasted any of his food. He would not have...
Was the food really good?
Food was excellent. Food was incredible. In fact, Charlie has opened a restaurant in Palo Alto after he left Google, and it's done quite well.
What was Google's CableFest 99, and how did you merit an invitation?
I was an employee, so I merited an invitation, which allowed me to go into our data center to basically spend a Saturday rewiring all of our machines. And at that point, all of Google's machines were...
Well, that was called a cable fest?
That was a cable fest.
So they made it sound like it was a fun thing.
Yes, they made it sound like it was a good time. In fact, it was a very hot room because Google had crammed hundreds of servers into this tiny little space that normally would have held maybe three or four machines. They had hundreds. And so it got very toasty.
There was a man named Urs, U-R-S?
Urs.
Urs. He'd be really upset with me because I say Route 69, not Route 69. What was his contribution and why was it so important?
Well, Urs was the first VP of engineering at Google. And he was probably, after Larry and Sergey, I think the single most important person at the company. He not only had the vision of the infrastructure and how it should be built and a very practical understanding of how and what could be done, but he also hired the other key engineers who came in and wrote the software.
But he had a hard time. He wasn't very good encouraging his staff, was he?
Well, he was born in Switzerland, and as he used to say, you know, and where he grew up, you know, it was a language thing. When you told somebody that they were good, that meant they were very good. If you told somebody they were very good, that meant they were off the charts. And if you told somebody they were excellent, that meant that they had just won the Olympics.
But if he wasn't telling people they did a good job when they did, would that have made him less effective as a manager?
No, I think, you know, the people who worked for Urs had such enormous respect for him, and that came out time and again in the interviews I did for the book. You know, I hadn't even been aware of it when I was working there. But everyone I spoke with just really gave him the credit for organizing the systems and building the architecture.
We talked earlier about how Larry and Sergey were kind of wary of marketing and advertising. Is that because engineering is a kind of a black and white world compared to marketing, which is a lot more ambiguous?
Absolutely. I think, you know, in engineering, something is either right or it's wrong, and you can keep working on it until you make it right if it is wrong. And things that deal with emotions and persuasion that is not driven entirely by data, I think are make some engineers uneasy, you know, and I don't want to be too broad in my characterization here, but I think, you know, it's not something you can quantify, and though they try very hard to quantify everything that has to do with any kind of decision, but people do also bring emotion to bear, and so I think it was hard for them to accept that.
What happened when you had to send out a press release?
Well, we sent out very few, actually, because my boss, who, you know, was quite good at her job, knew that it was more important to set up relationships with important journalists, and so she would deal with them one-on-one through email and so forth. But when they wanted a press release, Larry and Sergey would want to review it, and they'd want to send it out to the entire staff. All the engineers had to look at the release first before it could be sent out to make sure it was accurate and that it was the best way to communicate the information.
By that time, the press release could be out of date.
Yeah, it could be. But, you know, Google was pretty good about turning things around quickly. I mean, people were online 24 hours a day. You never had a problem getting an answer at 3 in the morning.
Now, despite all of the suspicion, they were pretty good at branding in some ways. The name Google.
Yes.
How did they come up with that?
Well, you know, the legend is that they were kicking around names in one of Larry's friends in the dorm room at Stanford, and that one of Larry's friends suggested Google, or they liked the idea of a big number because it implied scale, and they went in to see if the domain was available, and they misspelled it. They, instead of G-O-O-G-O-L, they spelled it G-O-O-G-L-E, and that domain was available.
Much better name.
Yes. And, you know, I think part of it was a business decision, too. Larry knew that he would have less trouble trademarking or, you know, protecting a name that was a made-up word as opposed to an actual word.
A number of listeners have asked the question I should have asked you. What was your answer to the question, tell me something I don't know?
So, the things I considered talking about were how to change diapers, because I was doing a lot of that at the time. And it's fairly complicated if you've never done it. And then, you know, how newspapers get printed. But what I ended up talking about was the theory of marketing, because I figured they probably didn't know much about it. I didn't actually know much about it because I'd only read 2 books on marketing in my entire career. So I was kind of winging it, and I made up a little bit of it as I went along.
What did you find when you asked for a copy of their strategic plan? And what were their venture capital pitches like?
Well, the venture capital pitch was a slideshow that Salar Kamangar, who's now head of YouTube, which is a Google property, put together. And it had Sergey didn't want and Larry didn't want to put any detail into the venture capital pitch that might be used by venture capitalists to help other companies in their portfolio. So it was very light on specifics. And
they got away with that?
They did. Well, they made up for it by putting in a lot of clip art cartoons of, like, trees growing money and so forth. So it was not exactly, you know, up to the highest professional marketing standards. But it seemed to work because venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, I think, are used to kind of unusual presentations, and they look more for what the idea is and how the technology works.
But in your case, you were hired to come up with a marketing plan. You came up with one. What happened?
I'm not sure I was hired to come up with a marketing plan. I decided I should probably come up with a marketing plan because when I asked for the strategic plan that they had, they told me there was none. They had never really written down anything about what they expected the company to do and become. And so I decided I needed to have some sort of a blueprint for my own work, and I did write a marketing plan, which they were fairly enthusiastic about until they found out what it would cost to implement it. And then they said, well, go ahead and implement it, but you can't have a budget to do it.
So. You weren't the only one who went through this. George Sala had left Oracle to become Google's facilities manager.
Yes.
And how did Sergey and Larry react when he proposed to create a set of standards?
With some heat, they said, standards, we don't want anything standard at Google. We want everything to be new and everything to be optimized. And that was pretty much their perspective on everything related to the company.
So it was really about inventing the wheel every time?
Every time. And, you know, there was this expectation that you had unlimited productivity, that unlimited creativity. that you could always come up with a better solution.
But you must have felt that you had gone to work at a madhouse sometimes. For example, Sergei's suggestion for how to spend the marketing budget.
Yes. The point at which he suggested, and having come from Russia, he was very familiar with things going on the continent. And he did suggest that we take the marketing budget and apply it to inoculating Chechen refugees against cholera.
Now that you had more money at this point?
Well, there was some money in the budget, or at this point it was actually theoretical money, But I think he probably would have been just as happy to eliminate the marketing staff and take our salaries and put it to that cause. But his belief was that, advertising was not effective, and at that time there was no AdWords, there was no Google advertising. So advertising was arguably less effective. And he just felt that it would be better to take the money and do something worthwhile and then tell the press about it, and people would start talking about Google as this great ethical company.
How was he dissuaded?
He asked Susan Wojcicki to investigate this, and she's still at Google as a vice president there now. And Susan checked with her mother, who was a high school teacher in Palo Alto. And her mom came back and said, well, I don't really understand why you would want to help, this war in Russia. And so Sergei was somewhat dissuaded because he realized that it might be a little harder to communicate what we were doing than he had anticipated.
Because both sides were not considered to be exemplary.
Yes, exactly.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, no matter how they felt about it, Google was ultimately going to have to turn to advertising as a revenue stream. How did the cost-per-click pricing work?
Cost-per-click was an innovation where previously online advertising, like regular advertising, you paid by the number of people who saw your ad, the number of times the ad was shown. So cost-per-click changed that dynamic and said you only have to pay as an advertiser when somebody actually takes an action and clicks on your ad. So if we show your ad 1,000 times and it only gets clicked on once, you only pay for that one click. And so that really changed the dynamic of online advertising because it made it much more performance-driven.
But this is the equivalent of something that's been going on in television for many years. People would run mail-order type ads, and then they would pay per inquiry. It's called PI in right. That business. So this was not a real invention, was it?
Well, except, it took it across an entire new medium. It was, per insertion or whatever. I mean, there were always metrics in advertising you could put in, business reply cards and so forth, and count how many people replied. But it was very difficult to say, I'm only going to pay by the number of returned cards because there were too many factors that went into determining that. In this case, the ad either performed or it didn't perform. And so it was fairly innovative, but even more innovative was the pricing method, the auction that they put behind it.
Why, for a time, was mesothelioma, did I pronounce it right, the most expensive keyword that you could buy on Google?
Well, because that was a disease that you might contract from exposure to asbestos. And so attorneys were looking for potential litigants in class action lawsuits, each of whom might be worth several thousands of dollars to the attorney in fees. So they were willing to pay quite nicely to have their ad appear on that term because they knew if somebody clicked on it, it was likely that they would be interested in becoming a client.
Even though Google had grown almost entirely from word of mouth, you were asked to come up with 100 slogans overnight.
Well, 100 banner ads. And so Sergei charged me. We had trades, barter agreements, with a number of other online companies like Netscape and Yahoo at one point. And so we needed to run advertising on those sites to take advantage of those trades. And so he asked me, or commanded me actually, to come up with 100 ads that we could start running and then see how they performed. And he had a very evolutionary Darwinian method of approaching advertising. You create 100 ads, you run them for X number of impressions, and you look at the ones that perform best. You get rid of all the rest. You take the top 5 or the top 10 and make more like those top 5 or top 10 iteratively until you come up with perfect ads that always perform.
This is his idea for do-it-yourself advertising?
Well, this was different. The ads that I was creating were ads that were promoting Google on other websites. The do-it-yourself advertising, which became AdWords, was where you as an advertiser could go to Google, put in a credit card number, and create an ad that nobody would review before it went online. It went online instantly. And so the potential for abuse was pretty high in my estimation.
The whole place sounds like it a lot of fun and also kind of scary to work with, work at, especially if you've come from a traditional workplace, being in a place where people are shooting each other with water soakers and stuff. Were you hopeful when Google hired Eric Schmidt as the CEO?
I was happy when he was hired, not so much because I knew Eric, because I didn't, but the fact that we had a CEO meant that we were that much closer to going public. There was a checklist of things that we needed, and a CEO was on that list, as well as a CFO and some other items.
And then how did Google – well, what finally happened there? Was the staff nervous about bringing in somebody like him from the outside?
No, because I think there was generally recognition among the people working at the company that the direction of the company was not going to radically change. Nobody really expected Larry and Sergey to give up total control and that Eric would suddenly be in charge.
When did people start becoming a little disillusioned, the whole matter of Google in China, for example? More recently, there's been the fight over the whole library that Google is creating.
Mm-hmm. Well, Google has always had large ambitions. And in the early days, Google was going up against other companies. When you're dealing with complex issues like China and book publishing, it gets a little harder to come up with an easy solution.
You left after the IPO. Had it stopped being fun?
I was tired. And it was time for me to leave.
And you've gone back to writing because you wrote this book called I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I want to thank you for being on our show, Douglas Edwards.
Thank you very much for having me.